Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Few with me, Boo, and an incredible guest today. Hard to figure out where to start today's story because there's so many layers to it. It touches on so many emotional chords for us as human beings. But I know when we have this few minutes, we are going to learn an awful lot. So with no further delays, super excited for this conversation.
Welcome to The Few Podcast.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
So you want to become one of the few.
You can't skip steps. You have to put one foot in front of the other. Things take time.
I have a dream.
Hear inspiring stories from the few and learn what it takes to turn your dream into reality.
Don't be afraid to dream big. But remember, dreams without goals are just dreams.
This is The Few with Boo.
Mike Hingson, thank you so much for joining me on The Few today.
Thanks. Really a great pleasure to be here.
So, Mike, your story is layers of inspiration, resilience, tragedy. But I want to just start with Thunderdog. And I think, I mean, I'm a dog owner, right? And I have been my whole life since I was a kid. With your journey, you wrote a book. The book was very specific. It was about a companion of yours. What was it about Thunderdog that really inspired you to write a book? And what was it about that connection? Just give us a bit of an insight into the book for starters.
So the book was about me and my guide dog, Roselle, who was my fifth guide dog. And yes, I am blind. I've been blind my entire life. And one of the most important parts about our story is teamwork. People need to understand what a guide dog does and what a guide dog does not do. A guide dog's job isn't to know where to go and how to get there. The job of a guide dog is to make sure that we walk safely. It's my job to know where to go and to give the dog directions. So the idea is that the dog takes direction, but we both work as a team and we both need to respect the other creature's job. And when we do, and I am the team leader of the team, but when we respect each other, we work together, it's a team second to none.
I do a lot of work in teams with humans and a lot of humans working together and a lot of unconscious biases that tend to kick in with those relationships as well as a lack of clear boundaries. Now, what is it about working with a dog and what was it about Roselle specifically that inspired you to write a book?
Well, the issue with Roselle and with dogs, and I'll talk about guide dogs, but it goes beyond guide dogs to dogs in general. While they love unconditionally, and I believe that, they don't trust unconditionally. But the difference between dogs and people is that unless some really incredible trauma has come along that directly affects a dog, dogs are open to trust, where we have learned not to be because we think everybody has got their own agendas and how can I trust this person? Yeah, they want to be on my team or they want to work together, but can I really trust them? And we don't learn how to better evaluate being trusting and being open to trust. And so when people started asking me to tell my story and to come and speak to their organizations and their groups, which I've now been doing since October of 2001, I talk a lot about teamwork and trust and leadership. And of course, moving forward from which you haven't talked about yet, September 11th, I worked in the World Trade Center on September 11th. And escaped with my guide dog because I knew what to do and how to get out. And I kept Roselle focused. And between Roselle and I, we kept other people focused and helped them get out as well. But the idea is it's really all about teamwork and trust. And that was an important message to start to get out to people. And so it was a great reason for really starting the process of writing Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust at Ground Zero.
So when we talk about trust, and you had a number of guide dogs, you're obviously a fully integrated member of society. Did you have an aha moment when it came to trust yourself and trusting others? Or was it how influenced was your own perspective of it? Or was it something you kind of took for granted, then realized? Because trust is becoming a bigger issue now for humanity than ever before, right?
Yeah, because we have so many politicians saying, trust me without ever doing anything to earn it. They create fear all over the place. Guess I've always sort of just expected the idea of trust, but I've learned over time that it still is a matter of being open to trusting and watching and working with a guide dog since I started with my first guide dog at the age of 14, almost 60 years ago. The idea is that when I'm open to trust and convey that to the dog and know full well that the dogs are open to trust, but they have to earn my trust and I have to earn their trust. And instinctively, we know it. And so after September 11th, I guess it would be true to say there was kind of an aha moment that said, oh, I really should talk more about that and try to teach people a lot more about trust. Because the reality is trust is all around us. I mean, you trust that this podcast is going to go out and people are going to be able to hear it and that the roof over your head isn't going to collapse. And I trust the same thing. And we trust so many other things in our lives. The reality is trust is all around us and there's no reason to not be open to trust. Now, we may trust someone and they may end up not earning our trust. They may betray our trust. Okay, but you still try. And then when somebody doesn't earn your trust, then you deal with that and you move forward. But you still need to be open to the idea of trust and, when at all possible, find ways to work with people. Because I think people mostly want to develop trusting relationships. Maybe sometimes they don't know how. You may end up being the teacher that shows them how, but we gotta start by being open.
You would have a particularly interesting perspective on trust, I would assume, Mike, as well, because so many of us, how we form trust or an impression of someone is how they look and how we see them. So how does trust work for you? Is it something where you have a highly attuned sense or feeling? How do you find the connection with trusting, particularly someone you don't know?
Well, I think you rely way too much just on how a person looks. Rather than looking at the whole person and looking at how a person is, how they behave, how they interact with you, and those are all things, voice tones, those are all things that can help you make a better determination of trusting someone. But ultimately, the trust comes from how people act and how they react to you. And that goes far beyond just how they look. So it is unfortunate to just look at a person and say, I can't trust you because you're all scruffy looking or you're a slick person in a suit or a fancy dress and I'm not going to trust you. Not the reason to develop or not develop a trusting relationship. It still ultimately comes down to how people react and how they act. And that is ultimately what is going to determine how well you develop a trusting relationship. Does that take longer? Yeah. But at the same time, it leads to more strong and better trusting relationships. And this worked with me with eight guide dogs. And the reality is that dogs want someone to be the leader of the group or the pack, as Cesar Milano would say. But by the same token, the trusting part is still something that is just as deep and is just as important and goes through the same process as you developing a trusting relationship with anyone.
It's fascinating. I think there's an element of that with, you know, obviously not just dogs, with humans as well. I think some people are more comfortable with having a role in society which is supportive and not necessarily being a leader. And others are just very, want to be a leader, but maybe they're not equipped with the right skill set.
Right.
Let's unpack the, you mentioned a couple of times, but let's deep dive on it now. You were in the World Trade Center during September 11th.
I was hired to open an office and I was hired by a company to open it. We decided that the World Trade Center was a great place to do it because in 1999, it was 6 years after the original bombing in the parking lot, which didn't do a lot of damage, but it caused a lot of people to move out. They had like only about an 80% occupancy rate. So we got a great office space for an inexpensive amount of money and took it and moved into the World Trade Center. As the leader of that office, I needed to learn what to do not only in the case of an emergency, but to be able to move around the World Trade Center. I had to be able to do the same things that any other person would do, take guests to lunch. So for me, it meant knowing where lunch places were in and outside the World Trade Center to be able to take people to lunch, knowing what to do in case of an emergency for a variety of reasons. I might be the only one in the office because I didn't want my staff in the office all the time. I wanted them out selling, supporting their manager, as I love to say. And so I spent a lot of time walking around the World Trade Center, learning everything I could, visiting with the Port Authority police, the fire department, the emergency preparedness people. And I knew everything that I could possibly know about the World Trade Center, what to do in an emergency, what would happen, and so on. And so when September 11th happened, and we were in my office on the 78th floor, and there were some guests there at the time, including David Frank from our corporate office, and the building was hit, the building tipped, because tall buildings are just big springs, and it literally tipped, and then it bounced back. And immediately the mindset kicked in, and I didn't even probably realize that I had developed this mindset, but I went, okay, I know what to do. So I was listening to make sure that the building wasn't falling down all around us, which meant nothing was going to happen that was going to save us, but I wasn't hearing that. My colleague David looked out the window and started shouting, oh my God, there's fire and smoke above us. We can't stay here. We got to get out of here. And I kept telling David to slow down. We had guests in our conference room eating an early breakfast that we had provided. They started moving toward the exit, and then they heard me say, slow down, David, stop. And David kept saying, we got to get out of here. There's fire and smoke above us. And there are millions of pieces of burning paper falling outside the window, and I could hear stuff falling. Now I knew what it was, millions of pieces of burning paper. David saw it. He told me. But I kept saying, slow down. Why? Well, eventually David used what I always call the big line. You don't understand. You can't see it. It isn't all about eyesight, folks. The reality is that what wasn't being observed was what I was observing that David wasn't. And that is that after the building stopped moving, my guide dog Roselle came out from under my desk. I took her leash. I told her to heel, which meant to come around on my left side and sit down, which she did. And then she started wagging her tail and yawning and going, who woke me up? While David was yelling all about fire. And I, knowing the dog as I do, knew that whatever was going on wasn't such an imminent threat to us that we couldn't try to evacuate in an orderly way. David wasn't seeing any of that. He just saw fire and smoke and started to panic. And the reality is that we can learn to control fear. And that's another story about a book that's coming out later this year. But the fact of the matter is that I knew what to do, and that mindset kicked in. So I was able to go to the stairs. David and I went to the stairs. We started down. We worked together. Roselle focused. I kept telling her, good girl, just keep going down the stairs. What a good dog. Kept her focused and doing her job. And she was doing her job, which told me that there was nothing going on that she was afraid of. So we kept going down the stairs and we made it out.
Hi, it's Boo here. If you're enjoying these episodes of The Few, please show your support by leaving a review. It costs you nothing, and the more reviews we have, the better guests we can reach out and bring onto the show to help you close the gap between what you want and where you are today even faster, and help you on your journey to become one of the few too.
Was it chaotic?
How did she stay so calm in that environment? They're just different things, I guess, trigger their anxiety or stress responses.
Well, there was nothing triggering her stress response because I was saying, I'm okay, Roselle, by giving her in constant encouragement, good girl, keep going. What a good dog. Just go down the stairs forward. Good girl. So she's, as I said, looking to me as the pack leader, and I'm telling her I'm okay. So she is able to focus. She had to sense fear around us, but I wasn't giving her any indication of being afraid. That was my job. But of course, that helped me by definition. And so we worked together. We helped other people stay calm. No, we didn't have a lot of panic on the stairs. There were a couple of times that it got close with a few people, but we all worked together and focused to go down the stairs. I think probably for me, the biggest panic time came when at about the 50th floor, my friend David, who I mentioned earlier, suddenly said, Mike, we're going to die. We're not going to make it out of here. And I just said in my best voice, stop it, David. For Roselle and I can go down these stairs, so can you. And he told me later that that kind of brought him out of his funk. But what he decided he wanted to do was to walk a floor below us on the stairs and shout up to me everything that he could see, because that gave him something to think about. And the reason I mention all that is because as we're going down the stairs, so I'm on the 45th floor, and suddenly David says, hey, I'm on the 44th floor, Mike. Everything's good here. We're passing the Port Authority cafeteria, not stopping, and keep going down the stairs. David did something I think that was absolutely incredible, and that is that he was shouting up to me, but the reality is he became a focal point for anyone on the stairs within the sound of his voice. Above him or below him, people knew that somewhere on the stairs, somebody was okay. Hey, I'm on the 43rd floor. All's good here. Going on down the stairs. He also, by doing that, had to keep a lot of people more focused and, as a result, not panic. We knew we had to go down the stairs intuitively and not be in a panic mode. Otherwise, none of us would have made it out. And so we all worked to help that process every way we could.
Was there a sense that potentially more could happen, or is it a feeling that now we're heading towards safety?
We didn't know. We figured out an airplane hit the building because we started smelling the fumes from burning jet fuel, but had absolutely no idea what was going on. I don't mean just me, but anyone. There were lots of people on the stairs all around me, and no one knew. People always say, well, of course you didn't know because you couldn't see it. People need to get real. The reality is the airplane hit 18 floors above me on the other side of the building. I'm going to see it. How? The last time I checked, Superman and X-ray vision aren't real. And the reality is that none of us knew. Hundreds of people on the stairs that we were in and around didn't know, because nobody was on that side of the building close enough to know. I didn't know officially what happened at all until both towers had collapsed. And then I called and reached my wife, who was the first to tell us that two aircraft had hit the towers, one the Pentagon and a fourth was still missing. But none of us knew going down the stairs. As I said, we figured out a plane must have hit the building because we smelled the fumes from burning jet fuel, but we had no idea what kind of plane or what the details were at all.
I mean, you climbed down the stairs from the 78th floor, which must have taken a little bit of time. So by the time you escaped, which tower were you in at the time?
I was in Tower 1. That was the North Tower.
Okay. So not long after you exited to safety, I presume you would have sensed and felt the collapse.
Well, so we got outside about 9:45, and the first building went down about 10:04 or 10:05, and we were told to leave the area, so we walked north on Broadway, and we ended up being about 100 yards away from that building when it collapsed, so we were very close to it. As I described, the sound is kind of a combination of a freight train and a waterfall, and everyone turned and ran. I ran back the way I had come. David was long gone. He ran. I got to the next street up, which was Fulton Street, and turned right to get more of a building between me and all the falling bricks and debris, some of which kind of hit me in the ear and in the head, but nothing serious. But I caught up to David, and then we were engulfed in the dust cloud, the final dust clouds of Tower 2's collapse, and we ended up going into the Fulton Street subway station to get out of all of that. We were in the station with other people in an employee's locker room. An employee found us and took us to the locker room, and we were there about 15 minutes. Then a police officer came and said, you need to leave the area, and we all just went back upstairs and then turned west and continued to walk west on Fulton Street. It was about 10 more minutes, and then we heard that freight train waterfall sound again, and we knew that it was our tower collapsing, but we were much further away. Even so, we ducked behind a small retaining wall because another dust cloud was coming at us, and we just stayed hunkered down behind this retaining wall until everything died down and passed, and then we got up, and David looked around, and he said, oh my God, Mike, there's no World Trade Center anymore. And I asked him what he saw, and he said, all I see are fingers of fire and flame hundreds of feet tall and just pillars of smoke, but the towers are gone. You know, we didn't know. And it was only after that, about a minute or so after, that I called my wife and got through to her. I had talked with her just before we left Tower 1, my office, that is. So that was like 8:47 in the morning. And now it's 10:32 or so when I called her and got through to her and was informed by her of to what happened.
How do you process that? I mean, how pivotal is that to your life journey? I mean, what went through your mind and your heart and your soul as a result of that experience?
It's crazy. I know what you're asking, but the ultimate thing is, who would have thought? I still am not convinced that we could have put it together as a country, no matter what we knew, because a team of 19 people who decided that they were going to pull this thing off did pull it off. They kept their mouths shut, and ultimately, we didn't have the information to understand it, which is unfortunate. But again, I guess you could say that's an example of teamwork in action. And they did. But the bottom line is that who would have thought? What I have realized is this is not a religious war. These were thugs. These are people who want their way. But that's not what Islam and the Muslim church is all about. And they don't want war and this kind of thing any more than we do. We need to understand that this isn't an Islamic war. This is a bunch of terrorists who want to have their own way. And unfortunately, I could say we see some of that in our own political system today, but that's another story.
Yeah, it's a hijacked ideology, really, isn't it? That bad people use to manipulate others for their own. Generally, the people at the top of the pyramid here aren't in any harm's way. They're riding very nicely with the donations. Yeah, it's a challenge. But for you, in terms of Did you get it? Did you experience any of that survivor guilt, or did you feel like, wow, that was lucky? Or how did you sort of process it with your wife when you got home?
Well, lots of hugs when I got home, but I didn't have survivor's guilt because my faith is strong enough that I knew, and I realized pretty quickly, because people got a hold of our story and then we started getting requests for interviews, and I realized pretty quickly, maybe there's something I'm supposed to do here. And if I'm allowed to survive what happened, then I ought to see what I can do to help others. And so when I started getting requests to come and speak and to talk about September 11th and now so many other topics like inclusion and dealing with fear, dealing with leadership and teamwork and trust and so on, I learned pretty early that if I could help people move on from September 11th or other emergencies and tragedies that happen in our lives, if I could help people learn to trust and learn about blindness, that blindness isn't the problem, the reason that we have the unemployment rate between 60 and 70% among employable blind people is really because of people's attitudes and not blindness. And if I could teach people about guide dogs, then I would be doing something. So I enjoy selling life and philosophy a whole lot more than what I was doing before, which was selling computer hardware and technology. It's a lot more fun.
It was probably a lot simpler selling, doing that though.
Oh, I don't know. It could be a challenge, but it is a lot of fun.
If you were to give some sage advice, one thing that you've learned as a result of not just September 11, but your experiences, you don't have to keep it to one to three things. What is your tip to thrive in life as a result of what you have experienced?
Sighted people should learn to live more like blind people. What do I mean by that? Don't rely on signs. Learn. Know for sure. If you go into a room to hear a speaker or you go into a room for a meeting, make sure you know where all the emergency exits are. Yeah, you have the value and the advantage and the ability to use your eyesight to learn a lot of that, although there will be some invisible exits in larger rooms that you should learn about as well. But no, don't rely on signs. Why? Because if you have knowledge, that will help you learn to control fear and not let fear, as I would put it, blind you or overwhelm you. Learn to control fear. And as I mentioned, I think a little bit earlier, and I'm writing a new book that will be coming out in August. It's entitled Live Like a Guide Dog, True Stories from a Blind Man and His Dogs about Being Brave, Overcoming Adversity, and Walking in Faith. And it's all about the lessons that I've learned from my dogs that have taught me how to control fear. It is not to say don't be afraid. I will never say that. But I will say that you can learn not to let fear overwhelm you or blind you, as I say, but rather you can use that fear as a very powerful tool to help you, keep you focused, make your senses be more aware when there's a need to. And no matter what the emergency is or the crisis that you face, you can deal with it. We had no way of knowing that the attacks were going to happen on the World Trade Center, but every single person in the world has the ability and has to take responsibility for how they deal with the attacks that happened on the World Trade Center or other things that happen in their lives. And the reality is that we can take responsibility for that, and we can use our own knowledge and our own fear in those kinds of situations to become a lot more productive and to stay a lot more focused and not let others control us if we choose to really look for ourselves.
It's easy to hold on to hate, isn't it? And to not forgive and to blame, right?
Well, it is. And the reality is, of course, it gets back to that whole idea of trust again. The reality is be open to trust. Smile at people. Don't walk around with a frown. People say it takes 17 muscles to frown and only 3 to smile. So smile. There's nothing wrong with smiling at people. And even your worst enemy, if they never earn your trust because they can't or they choose not to, that's not your choice. You don't need to be like them. And you may just choose not to associate with them. But those are things that you can deal with and should.
I love that. I think that's so powerful. I can imagine if everyone on the planet was just open to trust, to give people the benefit of the doubt. The unfortunate byproduct of that is there are people that are going to take advantage of it, right? It's going to happen.
Well, it's going to happen. But when you discover that, you deal with it. I'm not going to deal with you anymore. I'm not going to associate with you. You're not going to get my trust in the future. You can beg all you want, but you haven't earned my trust.
Yeah.
And if you keep behaving the way you are, you never earn my trust.
I'm a big believer in that. I think in my own journey of a way, there's been times where you just have to make a commitment to just, oh, I'm not going to let this affect me. I'm not going to let it turn me into someone miserable. And you are genuinely taken advantage of. But at the same time, there's nothing you can do about that, right? It's on the other person. It's not on you. You didn't create the situation. And you may have been, in some respects, a victim of it, but you don't choose to be a victim after it.
That's right.
I think that's the choice. So, hey, Mike, look, fantastic. Thanks. As I predicted, I didn't think we were going to get a few minutes. We have done a few more minutes with Boo than we were expecting. But I think that your unique perspective and just coming at it with such a, not just a unique perspective from being blind, but a unique perspective with a unique experience that truly kind of transcends what any of us can perceive in life. And so much of the decisions we make and the lives we lead are based on our perceptions, not our reality. And I thank you deeply, and I'm very grateful for you to come and share your unique perspective with the few. If you're looking for Mike, Michael Hingston, HINGSON.com. The show notes are down below if you're watching this now, either on YouTube or on the podcast channel itself.
People will get to hear us again because you're coming on my podcast, Unstoppable Mindset, where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected beat. You fall into unexpected as mostly as opposed to inclusion and diversity, but we'll have to continue the discussion, you know, and it'll be a lot of fun to do. So, and I hope people will go listen to that podcast and lots to learn there. We have lots of interesting stories.
Yeah, fantastic. And I think that particular mindset you personify, Mike. So thanks again. And I can't wait till we have the opportunity to reciprocate this podcast in a few days. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that wraps another episode of The Few, and I'd like to thank our partners, without whom this episode wouldn't be possible. Firstly, Ode Management, an organization that brings world-class speakers into your event or organization to make a profound impact on your people to deliver the results that you want. And Afterburner, real-life fighter pilots, a team of men and women who for the past 25 years have helped organizations surpass their expectations, learning the tips and tricks fighter pilots use to win 98% of the time. If you enjoyed the show, please show your support by subscribing to the podcast, The Few with Boo, or our YouTube channel. It's been an absolute pleasure sharing the stories of these remarkable people with you. I hope that helps you keep the dream alive, but more importantly, equips you with a few ideas of how to turn those dreams into reality to help you become one of the few too.